Blog Talk Radio.
We are the UR Tennis Network. Our mission is to be the voice of tennis. We enlist a team of passionate enthusiasts to promote our sport. We strive to bring interesting perspectives on the many spins of tennis. Our goal is to provide the learners of our sport with current news and information from many angles. We seek active participation from communities interested in tennis, but tennis is not interested in them. We are expanding our outreach. Tennis is a true lifetime sport that needs to be talked about, and the UR Tennis Network pledges to pursue this idea relentlessly.
And gentlemen, let's get ready to be inspired! Introducing in the red corner, American Tennis! And introducing in the blue corner, your host for American Tennis, Mr. Chuck Griese! Ladies and gentlemen, time to get in the game.
And good morning once again. This is Coach Chuck Griese, and it's another week of American Tennis. Every Wednesday at noon on the UR Tennis Network, you can listen to American Tennis. But it's not just my program on the UR Tennis Network, folks. We've got a lot of great ones now. Jason Haynes has his College Connection program just 2 hours from right now, as well as you are on the UR Tennis Network. Lisa Stone continues to be a blockbuster program. Her Parenting Aces program every Tuesday comes to you as well. Steve Clark out on the West Coast is doing a fantastic with the Steve Clark tennis program. And John Denise. John has been running for this last year a great high school program coming to you from the state of Florida, where he gives you the latest on what's going on in high school tennis there. This is Coach Chuck Griese. I'm with you today, and my program is American Tennis. We're in our fourth year now of American Tennis, and we bring you many, many things, controversial and some not. Today's happens to be an instructional program. But often we'll talk about the political nature of play tennis and what's going on. My golly, we've been on it for this last 2 years, on and off, about the controversy over shortened scoring and abbreviated scoring system. I get so upset when I think about the attempts that to dumb down our wonderful game by the ITA, by the USTA, by anybody who would demean our game by just cutting it up. How else can I put that in a nice fashion? We tell you that the mission here is to stand up, address issues, not people, and you pretty much can say what you want, folks. We need you to stand up, speak out. It's very refreshing. You wonder why someone like Donald Trump is rising so quickly in the polls. Well, it's not just Donald Trump, if you look at it. I love Ben Carson, who's out there. I love Ted Cruz. I love some of the people that are speaking up, and they're not trying to be politicians. They're trying to be statesmen. They're trying to be citizens of this country and to say the things that need to be said. Now, I don't agree with attacking people, but I will tell you that these organizations that are bureaucratic institutions like the ITA, the NDUSTA, wonderful people, a lot of my good friends work for the USTA, but it's very, very frustrating, as we all know that one of my good coaching friends said recently, some of these organizations, you think that they hire somebody to the position of CEO or director of screw up, but he used, didn't use the word screw up, but used another adjective to describe, said that whoever does that should be getting a raise for messing up so much talent. And, it's just the nature of bureaucracies. I don't want to go there today. I wanted this to be an instructional program, but bureaucracies mess up great things. The next champion will not come from a bureaucratic institution. It'll come from an individual. You out there, or somebody out there that's working with the youngster that basically says, listen, I'm going to do it my way. I'm going to train this player, and I'm going to demand excellence and bring out the king and the queen, call to the king and the queen in this youngster, and not dumb it down. Anyhow, how'd I get off on politics there? This is supposed to be an instructional program. Edmund Burke said that all that it takes for evil to prosper is for good people to do nothing, good man to do nothing. And we want you to stand up, speak out. Always, we encourage you to take care of that circle of influence, that person who is right there in front of you. Your circle of concern may be big. Oh, my golly, my circle of concern right now. It's so frustrating with, the lack of just a championship mentality that we do not have in some of our greatest talents, But anyhow, the dumbing down, I wanted to talk today a little bit, sort of to set the table about pre-match preparation and exactly what the best ways to prepare for a big match. And everyone knows that matches are won or lost a lot of times before they go onto the court. Our beautiful scoring system favors the favorite. The favorite usually wins because there's such a psychological disadvantage of being the underdog. And as much as people might like being the underdog, underdogs ultimately do not win in tennis. You have to end up being the favorite in your own mind. And I wanted to come out of the blocks by saying that if you're the underdog, it's hard to cover it up. The seeding may say you're the underdog. The ranking may say you're the underdog. And bottom line, everybody in the world might think you're the underdog. But in your head, and this is so important, you must know that you can win and will win if you do certain things. But in order to do that, our sport remains such a pecking order sport because in order to do that, there's just no way to fake it. Usually players make jumps after they do the work that is necessary to make a jump. And in other words, if you don't work hard and you get some wins, you might rent the win, but you will never own the win. You might rent the win and feel good about the win, but you might climb a ranking, but you will quickly discard it. It's sort of like renting the game, not owning the game. It has a lot to do with the hard work. The hard work and preparation gives a person confidence. You earn your confidence through hard work. No ifs, ands, and buts about it. I have mentioned on the program before that the three elements of being successful is ability plus opportunities plus desire. God-given ability, opportunities given by parents, coaches, teachers, and the individual desire and hard work of the individuals. The ability, the God-given ability is a constant, and I always ask parents when they ask, does my son have enough ability or my daughter have enough ability? Do they have what it takes? I said, well, let's do the three areas. On a scale of 1 to 10, what do you think their athleticism is? And they might rate their youngsters a 7 or an 8 or a 9. Very few rate a 10. Very few parents would rate their youngsters a 6, so usually say 7, 8, or 9. Opportunities. What do you think about the opportunities you're giving your youngster? And the parents will say, well, we send them to tennis twice a week, and we do this and we do that. I said, well, what are they doing? I tell parents it's a 2, 2, and 2 as far as a 7-day. 2 days, 2 days, 2 days. 1 day off, but those 6 days, 2, 2, 2 plus 2 plus 2, should be 2 days you get instruction maximum, not 3, but 2. 1 or 2. 2 days maximum. 2 days they set up their own practices. They set up who they're going to train with. They set up their running. They set up their backboard work. They set up their ball machine work. It's very important for your youngster to use 2 days on their own. So 2 days instruction, 2 days setting up your own practice, then 2 match days minimum per week, 3 if possible. You can juggle those. 1 day completely also. I'd sell parents 2 plus 2 plus 2. So when the parents, I ask them opportunities you're giving them, I don't want them to hear that we set up this and we set up that and we set up this. 1 day a week has to be, excuse me, a lot of days that week, or a great portion of that week, should be the youngster setting up his own workouts. So on a scale of 1 to 10, what about the opportunities? Parents will say, well, we do this and this and this. And oh, they say usually 8 or something like that. And they don't get to go to the academy in Florida, or they don't get this trip to California. They don't get that. So they say an 8 usually. We give our child an 8. Okay. Now, what's their desire? How much do they have in their gut, in their heart for this sport? Now, there's the intangible that you sort of need to dig out and find out about your youngster. That's a tough one. This morning, I got my own youngster out. My two daughters did great. Well, my youngest daughter did great. My oldest daughter did pretty well this morning, but actually, my son did not want any part of hitting tennis balls between 7 and 8 this morning. So I let him sit on the bench, and he just sat there. And I said, you can pick up balls, sit on the bench. He ended up going over and hanging out, playing on some type of sand deal over on the side of the court and doing something else. And, boy, that's, isn't that a tough one as a parent when your youngster is just not wanting to be there? But I've learned that when those days are like that, you try to get a little bit of something done, but you just cannot force this sport on kids when they're not ready. It's like pulling teeth or making them play piano, classical piano, when they hate piano or something. It's a tough one. You know, tennis is an acquired taste, isn't it? It's like fine wine. It ages with time, but it's an acquired taste. Oh, my golly, how'd I get off on that? Ability, opportunity, and desire. We're talking about what it takes. God-given ability is a constant. Opportunity is parents, coach, and teachers, the desire of the individual. I'm trying to explain to you and to put out there that desire of the individual on a scale of 1 to 10. So let's see, if the ability is an 8, the desire is the opportunity is an 8, that's 16. And the desire is only a 5, that's 16 plus. That's 21. Folks, I've done this for so long that the magic number is 23 to 25. So if your youngster has between 23 to 25, they got a shot at playing college tennis or beyond. 23 is sort of the bare minimum there. 24, good chance. 25, they're going to take off. 26, 27, they're going to the moon. But always that intangible part of the desire is the most important thing. And anybody watched the U.S. Open this last week? Who was it? Was Murray? He was playing that Australian kid about the second round that was so talented and just walked around and hung around like he didn't give a flip about it. And watch, it's really awful, the disrespect that he showed for the game. Oh, man, what was that kid's name? I'm trying to forget his name because it's so aggravating to see somebody show so little respect for the game and the greatness of this game. But anyhow, That kid, his ability looked like a 10. His opportunities were probably a 10. His desire was about a 3. So 23, yeah, he can make it on 4. If he had a 6 with desire, he could go to the moon. But his desire was about a 3, 4, or 5. And maybe that's just part of his image that he portrays, part of his MO, part of who he tries to be. But, man, he looked like, you know, just did not respect the game. Anyhow, folks, the desire part is huge. And I bring this out. I want to talk about preparation for matches today. But the ability, the opportunity, and desire needs to be 23, 24, 25 in there for sure. If it's at 26, 27, if that kid from Australia got a, you know, I don't know, take a bolt of lightning or what, a kick in the rear end or something to get him thinking about things the right way, man, if he was a 7 as far as 8 as far as motivation, we would see one of the most brilliant players of all time. I mean, if you look at Roger Federer, of God-given ability, it's easy to see, 9-10. Opportunities, obviously he had a lot coming up. He was playing a lot of good tournaments when he was young and everything. He must have shown promise. I don't know anything about his younger part of his career. Beautiful thing about Roger Federer is what he shows as far as the desires of the heart. He honors the game. So, therefore, the game honors him. It's a beautiful, beautiful thing to see, and we'll probably never see another one like him. Djokovic, ability and opportunities, great. Do you remember him early in his career, though? I'm not saying he acted like a punk some of the time. I mean, I don't know the guy. But at the same time, he was more arrogant, more cocky, I think, probably just young, not knowing how to handle things. But my golly, he works like crazy, and therefore he is a great champion. Don't we all love Andre Agassi's second part of his career? Ability was always there, opportunities was there. Second part of career, it looked like he honored the game more than he was trying to get the game to honor him. And that was just maturity about the game. So the overall outlook, ability, desire, and opportunity, if you look at those three, it's always those three elements. You know, the frustrating thing about this daggone NOAAD scoring, that the abbreviated scoring formats, the 10-point tiebreaker for the third set, the shortened games, the hokey-pokey show that they try to put on, and the dishonoring of our sport. There I said it, the dishonoring of our wonderful sport. The shameful, shameful thing is that it beckons to God-given ability, opportunities given, but it does not bring out the desire part. What's going on up there at the U.S. Open now is a little bit controversial with the heat and cramping and all these retirements that some of the players, I'm going to call them pretender champions, not maybe all of them. Maybe there was somebody sick. Maybe somebody had some food poisoning. But if you're going to play the U.S. Open, you better be ready to play 3 out of 5 sets in hot conditions. Isn't it disgusting that we say, what do they call it now? Heat-related illness? What? Didn't we always used to call that loss of conditioning? What, is that not politically correct now to say somebody just, the turkey didn't do enough training? I think that I got to read Roger Federer's quote, but Roger Federer said that I guess if you want to play here, you better be in shape and you better watch your nutrition. Are you not going to be able to play 3 out of 5 sets? And that's why the Grand Slam events are the greatest of all the events. And you don't see many people pretending them way their way on just ability and opportunity into great position, the semifinals, quarterfinals even, or definitely you don't see them winning very often without being fit. It's just a disrespect for our sport. It just is just aggravating is all get out the way these guys try to dumb down our sport. What in the world are they thinking? They're not thinking. They're guys that aren't in shape themselves, or they played a little club tennis, or they went to a school that was all just sort of bump and giggle tennis, or they didn't. They treat tennis like an after-school activity instead of the great, great warrior sport or warrioress sport that it is. It's the greatest sport in the world. It's like sophisticated boxing, the one-on-one elements, the drama. Come on, the drama of it is unbelievable. Kevin Anderson winning against Andy Murray the other night. Now, I've got to be honest, I usually flip from a couple of the news channels to U.S. Open, see if there's a match on that's interesting. Then I'll flip the golf channel, actually. There was a great golf event on this last week. And, you know, hey, hats off to young Daniel Berger, the son of one of my former players, Jay, on and finishing the top 10 this last week. And that Deutsche Bank, the tournament up in Deutsche Bank, I guess the way you pronounce it, the Deutsche Bank Open in Boston. Yeah, so I was flipping back and forth through these three. And here's Kevin Anderson, who came into the University of Illinois and was, yeah, he's a good player, top junior player, or one of the better ones. But I remember watching him play when he was younger, and what a good job that Brad Dancer and those guys did with him at the University of Illinois. He came in, and Kent Kinnear, also one of my former players, was there coaching. So you sort of watched the young man's development through college. Had a heck of a serve, but my golly, the drama of the match was beautiful because they got into that fourth set and it looked like he could be getting tired. He's 6'7" and it's heat. The heat was on him, and was he in good enough shape? And I just, you know, you were wondering if he was going to make it. And he, you know, the drama was pretty darn good about that match. I was pinned to that match, and very happy for Kevin Anderson, very happy for Brad Dancer, very happy for his program there at the University of Illinois and the nice job that they've done. The drama, what I wanted to make, the point I wanted to make is that the drama of tennis is what makes it. This no-ad scoring is going to be an ongoing mission, ongoing opponent, I believe, of those who love college tennis. The politics, the political people are probably going to have their way. They haven't listened to the players. 80% said, no, we don't want it. They haven't listened to the coaches. 70% of the coaches, men and women, have said, we don't want it. They're jamming it down everybody's throats. These coaches who are for this basically want parity without skill set, parity without having to get in shape, parity without having to learn how to play the game of tennis, which is about grouping points, 3 points in a row. No-ad, you know, you only have to win one in a row, don't you? And traditional scoring, you have to win 3 in a row. It's just unbelievable. 132 years we've used traditional scoring, and now these enlightened, what I want to call them, what names could I call them? And yeah, it's good I can't think of any right now, but these so-called enlightened folks in trying to make the game, they think making it easier is going to make it better. First of all, it just dumbs it down. It just takes away from the fabric of the game. And pathetic, pitiful, and what else? What can I say about you guys who are for this? Excitement? Are you kidding me? Excitement dwindles with each occurrence. Drama intensifies with each denial. It's about drama. Drama leads to excitement. excitement goes away. It does not lead to drama. Drama leads to excitement. Excitement does not lead to drama. Folks, we got to talk about pre-match preparation. How did I get off on politics again? We'll be back in a minute with American Tennis Coach Chuck Creasy.
This is Coach J.P. Weber of the We Coach Tennis Radio Show. In my 30 years experience in coaching tennis, I've never seen a better tennis training situation for children than Coach Creasy's Total Tennis Training Camps. Chuck Creasy has coached them and trained them in every arena from juniors to collegiate to professional tennis, and over 15,000 children have improved their games at his summer tennis camps. Find out more at ChuckCreasy.net. That's ChuckCreasy.net.
This is Coach Chuck Creasy, and go to ChuckCreasy.net for my latest blogs, my latest writings. You can get copies of my books there. You can also keep up with the camps and clinics that I will be doing. ChuckCreasy.net. Chuck Creasy, and we believe in making them in America, and with the talent that we have in this country, with the opportunities we have in this country, that's God-given ability and opportunities given by everybody from the USTA to the ITA to colleges to dad, mom, to good coaches. All we need is the desire part. That's it. We could go to the moon. We could go to the moon. Ability, desire, opportunity. We need all three of those things. Nurture, nature, self. That's all. I know psychologists will say, no, it's just self. It's all about desire. And sociologists said, no, it's about the nurturing. It's about opportunities. And then the geneticists or physicists, they'll say, no, it's all about ability. It's in the genes, man. It's all about it. Well, no, folks, it's all three: ability, desire, opportunity. And if you listened earlier, if you get to 23 to 25, rate those 1 to 10 with you or your youngster. You get 25, you're on your way. 25 to 30, you are really on your way. Let's talk about pre-match preparation. I give a junior handout to all the youngsters I work with, and it's very simple. It says pre-tournament preparation guidelines, and it talks about the week before, win a lot of sets. Real simple, win a lot of sets before you play. I always tell kids, win 6 to 10 sets the week that you're going to play and practice with players that you're better than. Now, here's the trick. Everybody says, well, won't that hurt you? No, it's not about the ball strike. You might play with better players, get your ball striking up, but you need to learn how to win. The trick to tennis is conversion of games. 3 in a row starts to flow. 3 in a row starts to roll. You must win 3 points in a row. In tennis, it's all built on threes. If you don't win a lot of sets the week before, you get used to losing because you don't win 3 in a row. It's that simple. But I've actually had situations where my last guy on my team, I don't care who they beat, I'll have him beat the manager before a match just so that they'd learn how to convert the games. All right, so the week before you do that, 2 days prior to the event, I usually finish the toughest part of the training and gear down the competition taper. Now, let me say in the off season, if we're playing small tournaments or it's the fall, we train through the tournaments. I even have the players running at the tournaments. Actually, they don't let you do that anymore. The NCAA, in their infinite wisdom or whatever, and I don't want to be critical, but they don't get it. After you lose, it's real important to turn bad pain into good pain. It's like going to confession. You get the loss off of the person, and I've never seen a person suffer for more than a couple hours after a tough, tough match if you let them go run or train afterwards. But we can't do that anymore. Can you believe that? What a bad rule. They thought it was cruel and unusual punishment, I guess. People looked at it as punishment. It's not. It's the way you reset the computer. It's the way you reboot. Go train after you lose. But 2 days prior to the event, you finish toughest part of training in the competition, and you taper. And then the day before, okay, here's the deal. The day before, you eat well, sleep well, get the equipment right. Just have a hit to get a good sweat up. Usually the day before, I don't do any more than about an hour and a half with the players the day before the match. If it's a new site, I'll try to get 2 or 3 short hits in. In other words, if we haven't been there before, I like to get there the night before, have a short hit, get up in the morning, have a hit, short hit before the players play. Usually 3 hits, the players start acting like it is their home territory in their own house. There's a comfort about sleeping in your own bed. There is a comfort about playing on a familiar tennis court. And people might say, well, they're all the same. Well, no, they're not. Each tennis court, it's the surrounding. There's a comfort to it. You need to become comfortable at being uncomfortable. If it's a familiar site, I'll usually 1 or 2 hits usually work all right. If it's an early morning match, you always wake up 3 hours before match time. Now, that's a tough one if it's a 8 a.m. match. 8 a.m., I usually will get the players up at 5:30. And you know what I'll do? A lot of times I'll have them go take a jog for about half mile or mile to wake up, then eat. Don't eat and then try to get ready. If it's an early morning match, get out of bed and go take a jog, then come back and eat. Get up about 5:30, take a short run, jump rope, break a sweat. Always eat about 2 hours before match time. No sugar, no crumb bum food there. I'm into having a nice, good breakfast, bacon and eggs, fruit and other things like that. And people say, bacon and eggs? Nah, you know what? The good fat is important for the players. Don't just go to the sugary cereals. Everybody knows that. But don't just load the kids up on carbs either. Before they play, have a good breakfast, bagels, and daggone peanut butter is hard to beat on a bagel, toasted bagel too, isn't it? That's pretty good stuff. Get to the court for your first match of the day 70 minutes before you play, usually 10 minutes before an hour and 10 minutes ahead of time. That way there's always stuff coming up for an early match, and you get distracted and talk to people, and you don't get the court you want, and you've been reassigned, and you're scrambling trying to find a backboard. Get there an hour and 10 minutes ahead of time. Just gives you enough time. Now, if it's the second match of the day, I always require the players to get there 35 minutes ahead of time. Now, how to use the last 70 minutes before your first match of the day? 30 to 45 minutes, the first 30, 45 minutes you should use with the physical warm-up. Dynamic flexibility is not static. Use your bands. You know, one of the things that's interesting, how we always warm up the legs, but those elastic bands, you need to do the same thing with your upper body as well. Use those elastic bands if you can. Your jump rope cannot be beat. Use that jump rope. Do the routine you usually like to do for your legs and your feet. Do some loading and unloading legs to get plyometric type exercises, fast plyometrics for part of it to get the legs and acceleration going, especially early in the match. If I notice my team is sluggish and the warm-up's going slow, I'll stop them and have them run wind sprints or line drills and get them tired to where they go, whoo, ah, ah, and they just can barely, you know, breathe. And you give them about 5 to 7 minutes of this to where, whoa, blow the carbon out, basically, because if you don't, they will have a sluggish start in the morning. But sort of watch what the heck is going on there. If the warm-up is, if it's sluggish, they got to get the legs going. That's some plyos and some fast twitch muscle things, anaerobic, short anaerobic sprints and things. Okay, for go to work, you can hit on the wall. Doesn't matter that much about getting the repetition with the racket. Remember, you already did that all week long, and I want to tell you, people who win matches usually don't feel comfortable before they play. Or no, they're a little bit nervous. They don't necessarily hit the ball well. When my players show up and hit the ball too great before they play, I said, well, they're playing. They're like underdogs. They're not nervous enough. What's going on? They're not going to play as well. And this is a strange phenomena, folks, but usually when players play crummy in their warm-up, they play great in the match. They play great in the warm-up. I'm talking about ball striking now. I'm not talking about movement, and those things are controllables. But the ball striking, when it's too clean pre-match, it's going to be crummy during the match. So if it's too clean, I'll shut it down sometimes, right, you know, and go on to something else. If you're particularly nervous and your legs feel heavy, just do those wind sprints or jump ropes. So I think 30 to 45 minutes is about right for your the physical part of preparation. Now, the mental preparation, there's a couple simple things I give all the juniors. Now, the mental preparation, I'm going to go into it a little bit deeper here in a minute, but these are real simple that even your young 10 or 12-year-olds can do. Give yourself 3 process goals, never more than 3. Now, the process goals are things like, okay, a high percentage of first serves. I'm going to run to the ball, not wait on the ball. I'm going to make sure I get deep into the point when I'm ahead in the game. These are process goals. These are not product or result-oriented goal. Pick these things that you have control over and that you know you can succeed at. Like, okay, aggressive feet. I'm going to follow my directionals and shot selection. My body language is going to remain good, and I'm going to stay in my after point. Each point, my rituals are going to do this. That time right between every point, I'm going to do this when I lose a point, this when I win a point. I'm going to do this when I hit a winner, this when they hit a winner, et cetera, et cetera. Also, emphasize that you basically do the things in a match, and you remind yourself to do the things that make you comfortable first. In other words, I want to get my serve locked in, and I want to get my volleys locked in early because I'm confident doing that. I want to get my ground strokes locked in first. You always start out giving yourself those things that make you confident in a match, and then you can work on the opponent's weaknesses. Do not start the match out by saying, I'm going to play to their backhand. Well, wait a minute. You might not be getting the right balls to play to their backhand. You might not have your game locked in. Look, always get your game locked in first. You act, make them react. I don't like the strategies we use a lot of times in tennis, and I'm going to explain a simple strategy here for matchups. But I do not like when a coach will say, play their backhand, play their forehand, serve here, serve there, and they attack attack strokes instead of a deeper strategy. You know, I used to say about Jay Berger, who was one of our greatest players ever, that I coached over the years, I used to say, take away their legs, beat their head, break their heart, and their tennis game will fall. Think about how we usually approach a match in coaching. We very often will address their strokes, the opponent's strokes, play their backhand, play their forehand, do this, do that. Well, we don't take away their legs so they get stronger as the match goes on. We don't beat their head. We don't break their heart. And their game stays intact. A lot of times it gets better. Best way to approach winning a big match is to do it from the inside out. You beat a player by take away their legs, beat their head, break their heart, and their game will fall. But the emphasis needs to be on doing those things that make you confident first, and then work on the opponent's things that they do not like to do. So anyhow, mental preparation, give yourself, during that 1 hour, that's 70 minutes before, just after you go through the physical warm-up, get yourself mentally prepared with a few reminders. Then the emotional preparation, now, it's important. Get the heck away from distractions like parents, friends. Get by yourself, youngsters. Players, get by yourself and get yourself ready to go. And it's always just, you cannot sort of haphazardly be in a social setting and then go off to the battle of the tennis court and expect to do well. It just doesn't work. You need to deal with the pressures and be by yourself. Music is good. By the way, not all music is good. Go to a great website, FastBrain, FastBrain.com. FastBrain.com, Dr. Jim Poole, we're going to have him on again. But do you know that they do with the ADD kids? They're doing a lot of music therapy. He's doing a lot of music therapy. With the ADD kids, he's really reinforcing the good things about ADD, calls it FastBrain. Most of you out there, if you're good tennis players, you got ADD, you know it. You gravitated to the sport because you could multitask. You also could be probably a jet pilot, a quarterback, and you do pretty well with multitasking. But most tennis players do have ADD. Don't dumb it down with those drugs, dang it. Go to fastbrain.com and see how Dr. Jim Poole up there is getting youngsters to deal with that ADD stuff. But no, before the match, we're talking about the emotional preparation. Have a place to get away from everything. And the music, I was on to the music talking about it. Dr. Jim Poole says that rap is crap, basically. Don't listen to that stuff or the hip-hop stuff. You need to listen to something smooth and melodic like beach music. Country music is good. He actually said some of the slow classical music is not necessarily that good, but the way he explained it, and I'm going to have him on the show here as soon as I can again. But the way Dr. Jim Poole explained it was that he said you've got to engage and smooth out the right side of the brain. The right side of the brain where all the creativity happens has to be smoothed out somewhat and not overloaded. He says the beat of rap music and the beat of some of that stuff just doesn't work. But anyhow, one of the things that we're going to talk about here, too, also about the emotional preparation is going to a plus-neutral state of mind. Well, what does that mean? We're going to talk about that one. Last, I've got here on this handout, butterflies are an indicator or the indication that you are ready to go. Get them to fly in formation and then go take the court. If you don't have butterflies, you're probably not ready. And it's really, really true. Whenever I've had to give a speech, when I taught so many years of classroom, in the classroom as well, I would try to get myself a little bit nervous so that I was ready. And the problem is, if you're not a little nervous, you probably are not going to be alert enough. You know, you want the butterflies to fly in formation, of course. You know, but pressure can be a daggone high-octane fuel for the person ready to compete. And, of course, if you don't use it in the right way, it's just goes the opposite. It sort of destroys. The pressure can give you a great, great steering wheel, and it helps you be focused as well. So get the butterflies to fly in formation. I want to give you a quick idea about the matchups and how to sort of prepare mentally. Now, what I just gave you was a handout that I've used for years with juniors, but I want to talk to you a little bit more in depth in about pre-match preparation. We'll be right back.
This is Coach J.P. Weber of the We Coach Tennis Radio Show. In my 30 years experience in coaching tennis, I've never seen a better tennis training situation for children than Coach Creasy's Total Tennis Training Camps. Chuck Creasy has coached them and trained them in every arena from juniors to collegiate to professional tennis, and over 15,000 children have improved their games at his summer tennis camps. Find out more at ChuckCreasy.net. That's ChuckCreasy.net.
This is Coach Chuck Creasy, and I'd like to ask you to go to ChuckCreasy.net for our latest blogs, books, articles, everything else that you might like to look for in tennis with our Total Tennis Training programs. As well, go to ChuckCreasy.net. And I'm back this afternoon and wanted to talk. You know, I wish I could talk a lot more about the U.S. Open and what's going on there. There's just a lot of stories and a lot of great things that will, you know, come down as, you know, people reflect back on it. I guess one of the big stories is, will Serena win her Grand Slam event? And she sure does look like she's gaining steam. Is probably going to do it. Roger Federer, I mean, who can't be for Roger Federer out there? Who cannot be? Kevin Anderson looks like the dark horse, and wouldn't that be a great story? We need a Kevin Anderson to come to the top. What a great, great example and role model he is to young people. It's fantastic to watch him. The humility the other night, and old Brad Gilbert was out there saying, come on, man, can you just give a high five? Can you just show a little bit of fire here? And, you know, Kevin's just such a class act and such a, you know, such a beautiful, beautiful testament to what tennis players should act like. And man, we need him to come up as a champion. It would be great to see him continue on his ways. We'll see. We'll see. But anyhow, we've only got a few minutes left here. I want to try to go into pre-match preparation again. So the physical, the mental, the emotional part of it, already hit on a lot of it. But I did want to talk about how you work the matchups. Now, most of us look in a reactive fashion to the matchups. In other words, we look at the other person's game and we say, hey, we need to play their forehand. We need to play their backhand. As I already talked about, one of the worst things you could do is be reactive and try to address the issues of the other player before locking in what you do. In other words, then they become the constant. You often are the variable. The best thing to do is always lock in your game first, and then you can address the issues of the other player. Now, what are the issues? It's not, at the highest levels, it's not about a forehand, a backhand, a stroke. And I wanted to make that. In junior tennis, yeah, you can coach juniors and get away with that sometimes. Hey, play this young lady's backhand. She doesn't hit the ball very deep. But at the higher levels, you cannot do this. I'd like to break it down this way. In other words, strokes are only the tools that you use for competition. But let's break it down this way. Let's evaluate the opponent's delayed pressure game. In other words, the delayed pressure game is their grinding. Their abilities to hold the baseline and fight off the base and play off the baseline in a with good high levels of accuracy, tempo, and all those things. Can they hold their own off the baseline? On a scale of 1 to 10, how well do they hold their own? Now let's look at the opponent's ability to attack or to play quick pressure. So you have delayed pressure is the grinding. You have quick pressure, which is they're attacking. Now, that means that serving and volleying doesn't happen very much anymore. But let's say they do wide and glides or body serves and attack the second ball and come in. Let's say, do they come in on the other person's second serve? These are quick pressure tactics. Do they have a quick pressure forehand that they try to dictate from the first ball with a big forehand? So on a scale of 1 to 10, how good is their quick pressure? Lastly, how well do they counter? How well do they counterpunch or play defense against your player's offense or anybody's offense on a scale of 1 to 10? Let's take an Andy Murray. All right, let's look at Andy Murray. Delayed pressure. Okay, now I'm just throwing these fits out there for you so you get an idea. So just his delayed pressure. How would you rate his delayed pressure in pro tennis? Would you rate it as a 8, a 9? I'd say it's between an 8 or a 9. Those of you who think an 8 is too low, don't confuse delayed pressure with countering. Quick pressure. His ability to terminate a point at the pro level, is it a 7? I don't think it's as low as a 6, but it probably isn't it about a 7? If you match him up in that league, in that level, his countering, oh, wait a minute. Now, his countering, is he a 10 or what? Yeah, he might, 9.5. Let's give him a 9.5. So what I'm trying to explain to you is that you take any player and you look at their delayed pressure. Where are they on a scale of 1 to 10? Where is their countering, their delayed pressure on a scale of 1 to 10, their quick pressure on a scale of 1 to 10, and their countering? Those three areas of their game. Now, match them up against another player, maybe your player. Let's say your player is Rafael Nadal. Let's match him up against Rafael Nadal. Now, we said, what did we say to Andy Murray's delayed pressure was an 8? Okay, now what is Rafael Nadal's delayed pressure? You've got to say that he's got to be a 9. So, you know, right there, if you just played baseline games and they grinded, you would have to say that, yeah, Murray's an 8.5, but Nadal's a 9 to a 9.5. Wouldn't you have to give Rafael Nadal the advantage a little bit there? Okay, so let's match that up. Now, let's match up Andy Murray's quick pressure, which we said was the secondary. What did we say his quick pressure was? His quick pressure was a 7. His ability to serve volley, his ability to terminate the point, the quick pressure stuff that, you know, and you don't, look, quick pressure is a lot different now. It doesn't have to be a serve and volley. It doesn't even have to be getting it. It might be just a player like that Australian youngster that played him earlier in the tournament, like second round. The reason Murray had such a tough, it was very frustrating for Murray. Murray was countering well, but the kid was still ripping winners and definitely a quick pressure mentality. But let's say Murray is a 7 on quick pressure. Now, Nadal with his countering pressure versus Murray's quick pressure, my golly, it's a 9.5, isn't it? So it's a 9.5. Yeah, so now we've got Nadal's quick pressure. What's his quick pressure like? Would you give him an 8? I'd give it a little bit better. But Murray's countering is a 9 to a 9.5. He's the best counterpuncher in the world. Actually, some people argue Roger Federer might be the best counterpuncher in the world. You know, he's got off. He's got, you know, come on, his delayed pressure is a, it's maybe the only thing as he's gotten older that might have dropped from a 9 to an 8.5, but his quick pressure is still up there, and his countering, of course, is through the roof. So let's give you the strategy here, Andy Murray versus Rafael Nadal. This is just a hypothetical. So in delayed pressure, You've got to give Nadal the little bit of the edge there, 9 versus 8.5. Well, so what, if you're Murray, what do you do? Well, you basically do not try to win every point. You basically try to neutralize off of the ground. When you're in delayed pressure, if you play 10 points and you know he's going to win 6, you're going to win 4. You basically try to neutralize there and you break even as much as you can, but you know you might off of the ground use certain tactics, you know, like this angle or play balls up the middle more so that you know maybe he doesn't have as much angle. Use your slice more to where maybe he can't feed off of the tempo. But, you know, and I'm just throwing these out, but if you were Murray, you would say, you know, look, I basically got to neutralize him off of the ground to where I match up. Now, about it, Murray's quick pressure is a 7. Now, he's not going to play a lot of quick pressure against Nadal. Nadal would cut him up. So he basically is going to have to be very patient in his delayed pressure. And then if he could get Nadal at all to play more quick pressure, how you do that, you know, he would have the lopsided advantage here. Again, Murray is 9.5. Nadal would be about as far as countering, Murray's a 9.5. Nadal would be about quick pressure is 7 to 8. So, anyhow, just like on Saturday morning before the football games, folks, you're going to have, look, when University of South Carolina has the ball, their offense, their quarterback and their passing and receivers are this. That's their quick pressure. Let's see, who do they play in this weekend? Kentucky. They'll have, okay, Kentucky, their defensive backfield, their countering of the quick pressure will be this. Who has the edge? Well, they'll match it up. So it's a quick pressure versus countering. When Kentucky has the ball, they're attacking versus University of South Carolina is countering. Now, the line of scrimmage is the delayed pressure. How do you match up that? And football coaches know that it all comes down to the end of the match. It comes down to the line of scrimmage. And isn't it the same in tennis? If your ground game is better at the end of the match, when you've taken away their legs, you try beat their head, break their heart, their game does start to fall. So anyhow, that's basically how you do the matchups with the mental part of it, with good shot selection, and that's the mental matchups. Folks, let me tell you real quick about the plus neutral deal. So there's only 4 ways that you end a point. You basically, you're good, you're bad, his good, or her good, her bad. That's it, 4 ways. Ideally, you're in a plus neutral state, so when something good happens on the court, you're good or they're bad. You are at a plus mentality. It gives you an emotional lift. You don't have to get in anybody's face. You don't have to make noises or anything or go, yeah, baby, or any of that stuff. No bully tennis. You know, you basically just have an emotional lift. But here's the critical thing. When you lose a point with their winner or your bad shot, that's the way you lose the point. You basically are at a neutral. Look, if you've got the wrong frame of mind, when they hit a winner, you'll be in a negative. You go, oh, what a lucky shot, or you're bad, you'll say, I've never played worse in my life. When you have this mentality, that is a negative. And when then you hit a winner or they make a mistake, usually you're in a neutral. So you've got to be a plus neutral instead of a neutral negative. I'm going to talk more about this. We only got about a minute, but we need to do it another day. Hey, I know a good way to remember it. My father used to sing that song, you got to accentuate the positive, eliminate the negative, latch on to the affirmative. Don't mess with Mr. In-Between. You can hear the whole song by going to YouTube, the Andrews Sisters or Bing Crosby, accentuate the positive. Folks, emotions have to be there. If you're there with your emotions, you will be in business. Folks, join us again next week. This is Coach Chuck Creasy. Sorry we got to go. We ran out of time. More next week. Maybe we'll talk more about pre-match preparation. See you next week. Made in America, born in a hot land. Chuck Creasy reminding you that you're in the process of winning or losing every day of your life, and it has very little to do with a win or a loss. Folks, try to help that person right in front of you. That is your circle of influence. I know we all have a circle of concern, but help somebody out this week. See y'all next week. God bless you.
Opinions stated by various contributors to the UR Tennis Network and its programming are not to be considered as endorsed by the UR Tennis Network. Participants are encouraged to use their own discernments and draw their own conclusions. All information, products, and services offered by the UR Tennis Network are for personal use only. The UR Tennis Network does not confirm nor deny the validity or accuracy of information contained within the network. Any products or services provided for should be used solely for entertainment purposes. We emphasize the idea of keeping an open mind and not construing the products, services, or data as factual.